subversive women in the Civil War.
I've always been interested in subversive women, when women who sort of were ahead of their time, who bucked trends, who sort of paved a way, and maybe their stories have been lost to history. And I thought, surely there are some women in the Civil War who fit that bill, and sure enough, there was.
That's Karen Abbott. We talk with her about her latest book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. It's about four courageous women of the Civil War who made history. And later, we replay our 2013 interview with Lois Levine about her novel, The Secrets of Mary Bowser. It's about a Union spy right inside the Confederate White House who was an African-American ex-slave masquerading as a slave. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When we think of the role women played in the Civil War, most of us think of nurses tending wounded soldiers or housewives making bandages. But my guest, Karen Abbott, tells the thrilling stories of four women spies, two for the Union side and two for the Confederates, whose daring exploits influenced the course of the war. There was Belle Boyd, who shot a Union soldier in her home, became a spy for the Confederate Army, seduced Yankees and rebels alike, and developed an unhealthy obsession with General Stonewall Jackson. The 19-year-old Emma Edmonds disguised herself as a man, enlisted in the Union Army, went undercover as a spy, and exhibited undaunted courage as she undertook death-defying adventures in her service to the Union cause. Rose Greenhow was a Washington Belle who made no secret of her Confederate sympathies, yet managed a major spy operation in the heart of the nation's capital. She turned powerful Northern politicians into founts of information by seducing them with her feminine charms, and even undertook diplomatic missions to Europe to drum up support for the Confederacy. And finally, there was the incredibly courageous Elizabeth Van Lew in the Confederate capital of Richmond, Virginia. She hid escaped Union prisoners in her home and organized a far-reaching spy ring right under the noses of rebel detectives, including placing a slave she had freed as a spy in the Confederate White House. We'll hear more about that spy, Mary Bowser, later in the show. Karen Abbott is the New York Times best-selling author of Sin in the Second City and American Rose. She's a regular contributor to Smithsonian.com and also writes for Disunion, the New York Times series about the Civil War. Well, Karen Abbott, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and I should explain. Now, you've written two previous best-selling histories, Sin in the Second City, which was about a famous brothel in Chicago, and American Rose, which was about Gypsy Rose Lee and America in the 20s. Gypsy Rose Lee was the stripper. And now you have written this really marvelous book about spies, women spies, and one who was a soldier during the Civil War. Why did you decide to write this book about women who were instrumental in the history of the Civil War?
Honestly, I hadn't given much thought to the Civil War during school or even afterward when I worked as a journalist. And I'm from Philadelphia, and my husband's job brought us down to Atlanta in about 2001. And it was an immediate culture shock for me. I hadn't realized that the Civil War was still quite alive down there. People talk about it frequently. You know, they have jokes about it. There are Confederate flags on lawns, which I had never seen before. And one day I got stuck behind a pickup truck in Atlanta's horrific traffic. It's legendary traffic. And I was stuck behind this pickup truck for about an hour. And the bumper sticker on the truck said, "Don't blame me. I voted for Jeff Davis." And it kind of floored me. And I thought, well, you know what? Maybe there are some characters there. There's some unmined territory. And I've always been interested in subversive women, women who sort of were ahead of their time, who bucked trends, who sort of paved a way. And maybe their stories have been lost to history. And I thought, surely there are some women in the Civil War who fit that bill. And sure enough, there was.
Yeah, and these are marvelous characters, just outsized personalities. Let's go in and just, introduce these four magnificent women to our listeners. Let's start with how you start. You start the book with Belle Boyd, yeah, and with an amazing scene.
Belle Boyd is probably one of my favorites. She's such a spitfire. When the war opens, she's 17 years old. She's a rebel, but she's sort of apolitical. She's not, you know, overly invested in slavery, although her family did own slaves, but she has a slave that she's very close to. So she's sort of just for the rebels because that's what her family is, and she has that allegiance. And the Union soldiers on the 4th of July were coming down from a victory in the Shenandoah Valley, and they were planning a big 4th of July Day celebration parade in her hometown of Martinsburg, which was in Virginia at the time. Today it's West Virginia. And Belle was enraged about this. She didn't want the Yankees coming to her town. They came through, they started pillaging everything. They emptied distilleries. They were spilling wine and liquor everywhere. They were stealing and looting. And Belle was ready. Belle was sitting at her home waiting for them with her mother and her loyal servant, Eliza. And Belle had a gun by her side. And she knew they were going to come knocking on her door. And sure enough, they did. And when they threatened to raise a Union flag over her home, Belle just lost it. And she shot a Union soldier and kicked off the war that way and was very defiant about it.
And this introduces you to her personality. I mean, she was not what you'd called a particularly stable personality. Tell us more about her and then where she went from there.
Well, Belle, I think she was all id. I mean, this is somebody who had absolutely no filter, who had no, anything she thought she automatically did. There was absolutely no consciousness or sort of introspection. And she seized the moment. I think she saw that this was her chance to make a mark. She was somebody who had always, from childhood, wanted to present herself in a dramatic way and sort of cause trouble as a child. There's one anecdote about her riding her horse into her parents' dinner party because they told her she was too young to join. And she gallops in there on her horse and says, "Well, my horse is old enough, isn't he?" So, you know, that's the kind of personality we're dealing with. And she seizes the moment, and it sort of uses her connections in the Confederate Army to become a courier and spy, and really is quite wily about it. And the interesting thing about Belle was all of the accounts of her, most of them just talk about how she had, you know, her face was not conventionally beautiful. She was not a beautiful woman, but she was so charismatic. People just gravitated toward her. And that's something I really tried to get across in the book, that the people just couldn't help wanting to know what Belle was doing and what she was saying and what she would do next.
To be a spy, I mean, we think of being a spy as somebody who is very good at controlling their impulses, of fading into the woodwork and skulking around. And of course, she didn't do that, but she was successful as a spy. How did that happen? What kinds of methods did she use, and how did she get away with it?
Well, I think the temptress part of the title would apply to Belle. Belle seduced everybody, Union, Confederate, generals, soldiers, their aides. And there's one story, which I was delighted to find, that she was, quote unquote, closeted for 4 hours with Union General James Shields. And then after her conquest, wrapped a rebel flag around his head in sort of a victory lap. She seduced somebody to get information about a war council. And of course, she had this really sort of strange, peculiar obsession with General Stonewall Jackson, the famous Confederate general. And she talked about occupying his tent and sharing his dangers. So she really wanted to sort of get on the radar of these men. And you know, in a way, you sympathize with her. You know, women had no control. They couldn't influence wars. They had no vote. They had no access to political discourse. This is what they could do. And Belle did it better than most.
And maybe almost her polar opposite then would be, on the Union side, would be Elizabeth Van Loo.
Yeah, Elizabeth Van Loo was an interesting character because she was so, she was the epitome of a spy. This is somebody who, as a young girl, and this was another interesting piece of research I found, she would doodle over and over in her notebook, "Keep your mouth shut, your ears and eyes open." So, and she really lived by that creed. She was very discreet, very smart, very calculating, and knew how to use her Southern manners to sort of give an aura of she was beyond reproach. So even though she was sneaking around and hiding Union prisoners in her home and helping facilitate prison escapes and spying for General Grant, if anybody accused her or suspected her, she said, "How dare you accuse an unprotected lady is beneath the conduct of an officer and a gentleman." So she sort of used these constructs. You know, women weren't supposed to be waging war, and she knew how how to use that and manipulate that to sort of turn the table on her accusers.
Now, she was from Richmond. She came from a wealthy family, lived in this gorgeous mansion. Yeah. How did she become involved on the Union side?
Well, she, her parents were both from the North, so she was already a suspect in her neighborhood. Oh, you know, she had Yankee blood. But her father went a long way toward trying to establish themselves as respectable Southerners. He did own slaves. He was a very wealthy businessman who built several prominent buildings in Richmond. The family hosted these elaborate parties. Edgar Allan Poe would come and read The Raven. He read The Raven there. They were sort of the highlight of the Richmond society. And once he died, Elizabeth decided that she had been educated up north. She had been up in Philadelphia under the care of an abolitionist governess and brought these ideals back with her. And so when her father died, she decided to start freeing all the slaves that the family owned. And she even started spending her inheritance trying to buy slaves and free them so they could be reunited with their families. So it was something that was just very dear to her heart, the abolitionist cause.
And then she devised this amazing plot to recruit somebody right into the White House, the Confederate White House, to spy on President Jefferson Davis. Who was that?
The woman's name was Mary Jane Bowser, and she was somebody who had been enslaved by the Van Loo family. She was born into slavery in the Van Loo family, and as soon as Elizabeth's father died, Elizabeth freed Mary Jane, and she took a liking to the girl. She noticed that she was very smart from a young age. She educated her. She sent her to missionary trips. She brought her back. She really took her under her wing and cared for her like she was her own daughter. Elizabeth never married and had children, and Mary Jane Bowser sort of was a surrogate daughter to her. And the brilliance of this plan was that, of course, nobody knew that Mary Jane had a photographic memory. Nobody knew Mary Jane was highly literate and very smart. And so when Elizabeth goes to Verena Davis, the Confederate First Lady, and says, "Oh, I've heard you need help, and I do have a servant." You know, she stumbles sometimes in her presentation, but she's a loyal girl. You know, Verena doesn't suspect anything, and of course Mary Jane has her in, and Elizabeth just has to wait right for the right moment to activate her as an agent.
So she began by visiting Union prisoners. Talk about that.
Elizabeth was very crafty and not only used the sort of Southern manners to protect herself and to sort of give herself a sheen of innocence, but she also quoted from the Bible frequently to sort of ground her behavior in a way that nobody could object to it. So she would go to visit the Union prisoners and the guards would say, "Why aren't you visiting our men? Why aren't you visiting the Confederates?" And she would say very piously, "The Lord says to visit our enemies first, to help our enemies, and these are our enemies, and I am on our side." And so she sort of presented herself that way, and they really couldn't object to it. It was a subversive, brilliant way to get her in.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Karen Abbott about her latest book, Liar, Temptress, Soldiers, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Well, let's move on now to Emma Edmonds. She's a fascinating character. She wasn't a spy. She was actually a soldier.
Well, she enlisted. She was somebody who, about 400 women disguised themselves as men and enlisted in the armies on both Confederate and Union sides. Emma was one of the rare ones who was living as a man before the war, and she has a really fascinating backstory about how she had to escape her family in order to avoid this marriage that her father had arranged, and dresses as a man and thinks that's the only way she's going to be able to get away with it. And then she enlists in the army, I think partly for a sense of adventure and partly because she did believe in the abolitionist cause. But I think mostly because she wanted to see what would happen. She was somebody who was yearning for adventures and excitement. And she enlists as a man named Private Frank Thompson and distinguishes herself quite early. She becomes a mail carrier and delivers the mail and becomes a courier delivering messages to generals. And then she becomes a spy and goes undercover several times. And sort of has some various adventures there, dressing up as a male slave, dressing up. One of my favorites was this woman disguising herself as a man, disguising herself as a woman. So that was one of her costumes as an Irish peddler woman. It was a very Victor Victoria moment there. And she had quite a lot of adventure on the way during her undercover missions.
That's right. I'd forgotten about that because I think I was so struck by the early work that she'd done. And she had done a lot of work in helping wounded soldiers, and that was quite striking.
Yeah, she was a nurse. She started out as a nurse in addition to her duties as mail carrier. And the nursing duties were interesting. She, you know, had to bathe men and sort of just the idea that she was flouting Victorian conventions by being with these naked men was quite an interesting thing to research. And she also meets somebody on the job, a fellow soldier by the name of Jerome Robbins, and develops an interest in him that probably is not proper and probably is one that is dangerous. If anybody knows that she's a woman, she could be arrested for prostitution. She could be kicked out of the army. She might be imprisoned. And so she's really taking a risk by if she decides to share her feelings with him.
And he returned her feelings.
Well, he returned her affections as a friend, but he had somebody back at home. And it became a source of tension for her. Every time she see him, she would sort of shy away. And they do this dance throughout. You know, Jerome doesn't want to entirely lose her affections. He enjoys the attention. But Emma is just sort of like, well, you didn't want me, and moves on. But their dance is an interesting love story in the book, I think.
Yeah, because there is a point at which she reveals herself to him because she is smitten with him. And he does not respond well.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that was one of the most heartbreaking scenes to me. She really literally laid herself bare for him. And I think that's probably the first time she did that with a man. Here's somebody who pretended to court women just so her friends wouldn't think she was queer when she was disguising herself as a man. And this is the first time she was really trying to develop a heterosexual relationship and a love interest she thought might be viable. And to have that rejection on top of the fear of, oh my God, he knows my secret now, what's going to happen, was really probably overwhelming for her.
And yet later on, it seems that he can't forget her. That he also, I mean, the implication is that he falls in love with her. But at that point, he finds out that she's with someone else. I want to ask you, how were you able to trace, I mean, this is almost novelistic in the way it's developed. How are you able to trace the back and forth, the development of this relationship in the personal feelings that each of them had?
Well, luckily, Jerome was a prolific diary writer. He wrote about everything I think I mentioned in the book. He was a Christian like Emma, and they talked a lot about God and about how they disapproved of all the men who were gambling and playing cards and drinking and going to the whorehouses. You know, they sort of bonded over their shared piety. And so they talked a lot about that. And Jerome had, you know, this diary where he talks incessantly about his relationship with God and the whores and how he needs to stay away with them. And he also quite often mentions his friend Frank Thompson. And he says things like, Frank and I enjoyed a lovely nap on a couch today. And I'm just sitting there thinking, wow, can you imagine what Emma felt? You know, here she is laying on a couch with this man who doesn't yet know that she's a woman. And how titillating that must have been for her to be so close to a man in that way and to still have this secret. She just must have been bursting.
She went through incredible privations, injuries. I mean, I'm amazed she made it through the Civil War alive. Yeah. You know, you think of undaunted courage.
Yeah, she was a strong woman. I mean, you have to remember, too, she was only 19 years old when she enlisted and turned 20 shortly after she joined the Army. And so she was a young woman and robust. She was a tomboy. She was the one who was always doing the manual labor on the farm where she grew up in Canada. So she was sort of well-positioned, and she knew how to shoot a gun, and she knew how to fight. She was not a you know, wilting flower by any means. But still, she suffered from malaria. She got injured in a mule accident. You know, just the physical labor of carrying bodies, a dead body she would carry daily, you know, every time one of her comrades was wounded or injured, she was involved in sort of transporting all of those bodies. I mean, it just probably took a huge toll on her physically. And I know she had physical problems for the rest of her life after the war.
And then finally, we mention another very flamboyant character. It does seem that the two Confederate spies were distinguished by their flamboyance, whereas the Union ones, not so much. And that was Rose O'Neill Greenhow. She was a Washington Belle and was quite a noted beauty and had lots of affairs with important men.
You know, Rose, on the surface, it doesn't seem a sympathetic character if you just hear her speak. She was a virulent racist. Her family had grown up owning slaves. She talked often about how the white race was superior, and that's why she's fighting this war. But if you sort of scratch below the surface of that, here's a woman who's really deeply wounded. She lost 5 children within 4 years. Her husband died. She lost her husband. Her husband never knew her youngest daughter. She had been the belle of Washington society for, you know, 20 years of rule. New presidents, new senators, new everybody was well positioned. And all of that was taken away from her with Lincoln's inauguration. So she's, in one fell swoop, loses her position in society, her husband, 5 of her children, at risk of losing her home, and her remaining children, too. And I think she just went into a tailspin, and anything she could have done to preserve her position, she was going to do. And she was quite ruthless about it, and as you said, took on many lovers who were instrumental in providing her very important information for the Confederate Army.
And how did she get away with it, although she ultimately was found out, but before then, how did she get away with her spying? Because she was quite open about her Confederate sympathies. Yeah.
She was quite open about it, and I think that probably partly led to her downfall, because she was so proud of herself, and she couldn't help herself. I think this is somebody who could not help herself, much in the way Belle couldn't help herself. But Rose was quite ingenious, and she used, you know, women, in addition to hiding behind the construct of what a woman should act like, you know, they're proper, she also physically used women's bodies to hide things. She would hide dispatches in her courier's hair. She had the 16-year-old courier, and Rose did her hair up in a bun and tucked a dispatch in there and sent her off to Confederate Beauregard. This was on the eve of the First Battle of Bull Run. And that piece of information helped lead to a Confederate victory. So, you know, nobody suspected to check this 16-year-old girl's bun. And, you know, she gets down to headquarters and undoes her hair, and this glorious mane falls out, and here's your information. So it was quite ingenious the way they sort of organized themselves and got away with it.
And then there's a character that pops up in relationship to her that I'd never known his Civil War history. This was Alan Pinkerton of the Pinkerton Detective Agency, who I really have always associated with the Red Scare of the 1920s and his unrelenting hunt for progressives and anarchists and people like that.
Yeah, Pinkerton, pretty early in the Civil War, decided to offer his services to the Union and recruited a bunch of spies on his team, both men and women. And one of his first assignments was to conduct surveillance on the Washington widow, Rose O'Neill Greenhow. And so there's a great comic scene where Pinkerton and a few of his fellow detectives stake out Rose's home in the pouring rain and watch as this Union captain, this traitorous Union captain, comes in, and he and Rose are quite cozy. And Pinkerton is enraged and decides that, you know, Rose needs to be apprehended as soon as possible.
And ultimately, she gets arrested and put into prison. Tell us about the prison and also about her young daughter who was in prison with her.
That's another way that Rose, I think, was ruthless. I mean, even her young daughter, her namesake, little Rose, who was an 8-year-old girl at the time the Civil War broke out, Rose decided that she would be useful in her espionage adventures. And so when Rose was imprisoned in her home, they did a home imprisonment for several months. She would tuck information into her daughter's pantalettes and send her out into the yard. You know, the guards just thought the girl was out there playing, but no, she was waiting for some of Rose's spies to pass by, and they would pretend they were giving little Rose candy, but actually they were giving information to Rose, and little Rose was passing on her mother's note in return. So she even put her young daughter at risk. I mean, this was something that she felt was necessary, and it was probably, you know, necessary for both herself and her daughter's livelihood.
We're talking with Karen Abbott about her newest book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. It's about 4 women who went undercover during the Civil War. You've talked about Bull Run, and that was a devastating loss for the Union Army early in the war. What was some of the other information that Rose passed on that was instrumental in the course of the Civil War?
She passed on some information about the Union's Anaconda Plan, which was the Union blockade, part of the Union blockade, which was the strategy to starve the Confederacy of supplies, which was a very effective strategy. I mean, the South, pretty early in the war, was experiencing a shortage of goods and food, coffee, arms, medicine, etc., which opened up, you know, quite a smuggling business. And one of my favorite tidbits from the war is how these Confederate women, Rose and Belle included, would smuggle things. Again, using the accoutrements of their femininity to get them across the lines. And, you know, their crinoline, you know, the big cage-like structure that people wore under dresses back in that time, could reach a diameter of 6 feet. So you can imagine all kinds of things that could fit under a 6 foot wide crinoline. They fit weapons, sabers, bags of coffee, material, even quinine. The women would pass across the lines and nobody would think to be looking under their skirts. And one of my favorite tidbits too was they would use their young daughters. They would hide quinine in oil sacks and put them into the papier-mâché dolls of heads. So even the little girls are carrying dolls that are full of smuggled contraband across the lines.
And why was quinine so important?
Quinine was used to fight malaria. Malaria was a severe disease that afflicted many soldiers, and there was a shortage of quinine from the blockade. So the more quinine one could get, the better the soldiers had a chance of recovering from malaria.
And one of the towns that was blockaded was Richmond, where Elizabeth Van Loo was. She probably passed on some of the most important information of the war. At least that's what Ulysses S. Grant told her after the war. Talk about those ultimate months and weeks and days of the Civil War and what happened at Richmond.
Well, Elizabeth's operation was brilliant in that it was so systematic and so controlled. And even when it grew to the extent that it was incorporating information from other states, it was so tightly controlled. And she was very calculating about who knew things and who knew what, and trying to keep track of, and it was impossible to keep track of everybody, but she tried. And she began by using a system in which she pricked words inside of books to ask soldiers for information in the prison. So she would take a book and do pinpricks forming out sentences, and the soldiers would send the books back with answers. So it was sort of a primitive way in the beginning, and then progressed. And finally, she is officially recruited by the Bureau of Military Information for the Union. And that's when her real trouble begins. She suffers death threats. People threaten to kill her. People threaten to burn her house down. She's followed all the time. She's afraid people are breaking into her house. And of course, her house gets searched many times by Confederate detectives. So she lived in a constant state of terror the entire war, which makes her valor all the more remarkable.
So what did she tell Ulysses S. Grant, that final piece of information that was so important?
The final piece was the position of Confederate troops around Danville. So it was sort of the last little push he needed in April of 1865. But there was a steady barrage from about 1864 to the end of the war, 1865. She was delivering about 3 reports a week that was consistent about where the Confederate troops were, what they were planning, what the rumors were, what the Confederate morale was, what Jefferson Davis was doing, where was Lee, what was Lee thinking. She had ins on all of this. And she not only had Mary Jane Bowser in the Confederate White House spying on Jefferson Davis. She had clerks in the Confederate War Department who were on her side. She had somebody in one of the prisons who was on her side. So she had sort of well-placed sources everywhere.
She was really brilliant. And talking about Mary Jane Bowser, she got to a point where she felt that her life was at danger.
Yeah, she throughout, you know, there was always a worry that Mary Jane Bowser was going to be discovered. And of course, that would lead back to Elizabeth and have dire consequences for both of them. Jefferson Davis's manservant escaped at one point. He was a Union man who fled to secretly a Union man who fled to Northern lines and began talking to the Northern press. So, of course, after that happened, Jefferson Davis was very suspicious of all of his slaves and servants and thought, of course, there might be another mole in the midst. So it just really heightened the danger for Mary Jane and Elizabeth.
And back to Rose now. She was imprisoned, but then she was released and she went to London. Why did she go there?
That was an extraordinary mission. It's unprecedented. Jefferson Davis asked her to go to lobby for the Confederacy to Europe. It was the Confederates' goal to get recognized by Europe, and thought if they achieved that sort of legitimacy and Europe was on their side and recognized them, the United States would eventually have to recognize them. So it was sort of a diplomatic effort, and he sent her over there. And I think it's the first time that any sitting president sent a woman over to on behalf of his country in a political capacity. And of course, Rose immediately charmed her way into the palace of Napoleon III and was all of the balls. And I just love that even over there, she never, you know, bit her tongue. I mean, she's somebody who told off Napoleon III. I mean, it's sort of, this woman really had no filter at all.
Karen Abbott. We'll talk more about her book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War, after the break. Stick around. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today about the amazing stories of five women spies during the Civil War. Four of them are the subject of my guest Karen Abbott's book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. Later, we'll talk about the fifth, the African-American ex-slave Mary Bowser, with the author of a novel about her, Lois Levine. The four in Abbott's book are Belle Boyd and Rose Greenhow, spies for the Confederacy, and Elizabeth Van Leeuw and Emma Edmonds for the Union. So back to Emma Edmonds, if we could talk a little bit about what happened after the war. First of all, three of these women, all except Elizabeth Van Leeuw, wrote memoirs, so I'm sure that that's where you got a lot of your information.
Emma did. She wrote a very interesting memoir in terms of she didn't talk about herself. She didn't identify herself as a man. She was very ambiguous in her language, but it was clear that it was a woman writing as her experience as a man in the Union Army. And so I did have that as a primary source material and a direct line into what she was thinking. You know, anytime there's a thought in her head, it's coming from or extrapolated from her memoir. But I had to do a lot of research around, you know, what was the experience like for these women who disguised themselves as men? How did they get away with it? And that was one of the most fascinating things to me, you know, the binding your breasts and cutting your hair. And more than that, men were so used to seeing women's bodies pushed and pulled into exaggerated shapes by corsets and crinolines that they just had no concept of what a woman would look like wearing pants. It was an unfathomable to them. So let alone in an entire uniform. So if you see somebody in a pair of pants, you just automatically assume they're a man. It couldn't have been a woman. So it just sort of, again, the construct of what a woman was and what a woman looked like was to her advantage.
But what about the voice?
Well, she was young, and the high voice and the smooth face, you know, she wasn't growing any facial hair, of course, they attributed to her youth. There were plenty of young boys who also had squeaky, high-pitched voices and smooth faces, and so she just sort of passed herself off as a young boy who was still not quite a man yet.
And then, so after the war, she went through some vicissitudes, even though her memoir was quite successful. Yeah. She got to the point where she was indigent, basically, and needed money. And she tried to get a pension. Talk about why that was difficult to begin with, and then what happened.
Well, I should say that all of her proceeds from her memoir, which was very successful, she donated to the relief of Union soldiers. So she was very selfless in that. And of course, she did have hardships on her own. She ended up marrying and also suffering, as Rose did, the loss of a couple of her children. And she moved to a town where there were a lot of Civil War veterans, and she noticed they all had pensions. And she said, wait a minute, I deserve this as well. Frank Thompson did his duty. But it was a problem for her because, number one, she was listed as a deserter. And number two, the Union Army, even at that late point, wasn't publicly acknowledging that women fought for them. They didn't want to acknowledge that actually had occurred. So she had to write to some of her former comrades and out herself. And all of them came to her defense. They all rallied behind her, and it was quite a moving thing. And she was really grateful about that.
So then Elizabeth Van Leeuw, I mean, at first she was rewarded with becoming the postmaster of Richmond, but ended up having quite a difficult time, never accepted by her neighbors, died finally in 1900, and then people began seeing her spirit. This is incredible.
Yeah. she became this sort of specter around the neighborhood. Of course, everybody was wary of Elizabeth in life, and even more that was amplified in death. And parents would reportedly tell their children, Crazy Bette's going to get you. You know, go to your room or Crazy Bette's going to get you. So she became this sort of dark and mysterious figure around Richmond. And one of my favorite stories, though, in that vein was a woman around the time of World War II was walking around. Elizabeth's house had long been demolished by that point, sadly. It was such a beautiful structure that it should still be standing, but saw a woman surrounded by many cats and sort of frettingly kneading her hands and saying, oh my God, I have to get this information to General Grant before first light. I have to get the information to General Grant. And then she was gone. So I like to think that even in her death, you know, Elizabeth still sort of acknowledges her own cause and is sort of proud of what she had accomplished.
That was amazing. And you say these sightings were quite common. I mean, how do you feel about them? When you were reading about them, did you say, well, maybe this is kind of a mass hysteria, or did you think, well, you know, this could have been?
Oh, I believe ghosts are possible, but I'm sure the sort of hysteria about a Crazy Bette and the reputation that the people had sort of made for her. She did nothing really to encourage this reputation, but she just became this sort of boogeyman. And I'm sure kids just sort of told tall tales and people just exacerbated everything that they thought could have been her.
Now, of course, these are not the only women who contributed to the war and even had some fame. I mean, Louisa May Alcott, for example, was a nurse. Of course, she got her fame in other ways. Talk a little bit maybe about what were the most surprising things that you learned or the things that stand out in your mind the most about women's contribution to the war and how these women in particular embodied that.
I like the way that they were sort of very devoted to their cause on either side. The Confederate women, there was sort of a collective personality switch that happened with Southern women. Here are women who grew up on antebellum plantations and their whole lives were planned out for them. They were going to become slave mistresses. They were going to be debutantes. They were going to run this plantation. They were going to be the belle of the ball. Their whole lives were privileged and sort of laid out for them. And all of that changed with the war. Their husbands were gone. Their fathers were gone. Their brothers were gone. Their beaux were gone. And not only were they gone, but the Confederate women encouraged them to go. One of my favorite bits was how the Confederate woman would embarrass any man who didn't want to sign up to fight. One woman was known for, she sent her slave over to her boyfriend's house with a package, and inside the package was a crinoline and a note that said, wear these or volunteer. So sort of, he got the point and he volunteered. But they shamed all of their men into fighting. And when Union soldiers occupied their towns, they spat at them, they emptied chamber pots on their heads, they cursed at them. Gone was this image of this genteel Southern woman, and they became like she-rebels. And there was even reports in the Northern press of she-rebels. So it was sort of a transforming experience for Southern women, but for women in general who just sort of said, we don't have to fit this genteel mold anymore. And it also quite changed the way women's marriage patterns happened after the war. I mean, a lot of Confederate men didn't come back, but the war left 70,000 widows, and some women just never married again, and it was sort of changed the courtship patterns. Courtship used to be very deliberate, and you had to have introductions, and it would last over the course of years, and now people were just marrying right away or not marrying at all.
Wow, that's so interesting, and that's because of the war.
Yeah.
You said at the outset of this interview that you were surprised when you went down to Atlanta how much people were still talking about the Civil War. And, you know, in the North, not so much. Yeah. After writing this book, did your perspective on the Civil War change or deepen or mature in any way? And how did it?
Well, I'm still glad the North won. But I just had a greater appreciation for, you know, the Southern men, the men who fought in the rebel army, most of them didn't own slaves. They were fighting because that's what they were told to do. These were poor people who just were, you know, this was what they had to do. It's sort of the ideology wasn't there for all of them. And sort of just being able to immerse myself in research and reading about them as people, and reading various soldiers' diaries, what they went through, the privations, the loss, and of course, all the women who were either left home or who decided to take things into their own hands. So just sort of a myriad out of experience that really just deepened my appreciation for this event that shaped the country, you know, more than anything else shaped the country. This was it.
You developed your career as a writer, not as a journalist, but as a writer, on writing these very fascinating books on the history, on women who break the mold. Where are you going next?
Well, I'm contemplating a novel. So a little bit of a different switch, but of course it's based on a true story. I can't entirely divorce myself from my love of fact and my love of history. So it's based on a true story of a female con artist who operated in New York in the late 19th century and sort of the weird turn her life takes when her past starts catching up with her.
And you don't want to divulge her name? Well, we look forward to talking with you about that book when it comes out. And this book, I just really highly recommend to our listeners. It's a great read, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Karen Abbott, thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a great time.
Karen Abbott is a best-selling author of Sin in the Second City and American Rose. You can read an excerpt from Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy by going to writersvoice.net. You'll also find photos of the four women from the book. Next up, we play an excerpt from my 2013 interview with Lois Levine about her novel, The Secrets of Mary Bowser. We spoke with historian-turned-novelist Lois Levine in March of 2013 about her novel based on the remarkable true story of Mary Bowser. As we heard in our first segment today, Bowser was freed as a young girl by the abolitionist daughter of her owners, Elizabeth Van Loo. Bowser was given an education in Philadelphia, and then she returned to the South to become a spy for the Union Army during the Civil War. In her novel, The Secrets of Mary Bowser, Lois Levine weaves history and speculation together into a fascinating narrative exploring slavery, the Civil War, and the relationship between two remarkable and courageous women, Mary Bowser and Elizabeth Van Loo. I asked Levine about that relationship.
I couldn't help but wonder, what would it be like to have this evolving relationship on either side, these two women doing something completely courageous, certainly completely illegal. They were executing spies in Richmond during the Civil War, so either one of them could have been put to death. And how did they figure out the relationship they were going to have with each other? At one point in the novel, Mary says that she wasn't really family, she wasn't really friend. Like, she, you know, that there's some bond between them that really we don't have words to define, but that becomes incredibly important to both of them as the novel unfolds.
Now, how much is known about Mary Bowser? You said you came across three paragraphs, and of course you had to invent a lot of this book. So say first, you know, how much is known, and what did you do to be able to create such a vivid and believable character?
When I started, I only knew a few facts. As it turns out, the Mary Bowser was baptized and married in St. John's Church in Richmond. And if anybody has ever been to Richmond, Virginia, you'll know that Churchill is the fanciest neighborhood, and it is named for St. John's Church. And that's the church where, during the Revolutionary War, Patrick Henry gave the famous "Give me liberty or give me death" speech. So it's a really important church. It was a white church, and it was extremely rare for any Black person to be baptized or married there. And even other Van Loo slaves were not baptized or married there. So I wanted to keep that. So things like that I tried to stay close to. But there really wasn't very much information, especially about her childhood in Virginia. And so that was a lot of inventing. And for me, a lot of the fun of writing the book was getting to understand this place. And this is a novel about slavery that doesn't have a single plantation in it, because Richmond was urban and industrialized, and the experience of being enslaved there was very different than what we usually think of when we think about slavery in America. So I did an awful lot of research, both reading other historians' work. I did travel to Richmond and spend some time in the city, but mostly trying to get the characters to be real and believable. You know, Mary's in my, because I get to invent her family, I invent that Mary's mother is from New York. Many people don't realize that there was slavery in New York until well into the 19th century, but her father is from Virginia, so that you get this sense of the cadence of their voices or the way that they react to things. I mean, her mother is really a New Yorker and her father is really a Virginian. And I wanted to do that in part. Well, you always want your characters to be individuals, but I think especially when you're writing about slaves, that you want to show, I mean, slavery is supposed to deny humanity, and you want to show not that just people are human, but that they're individual, that slaves weren't one big category, but people were very different in how they dealt with the challenge, not only of your own survival under slavery, but imagining what it would be like to try and raise a child when you have literally no legal right to protect that child.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Lois Levine about her novel, The Secrets of Mary Bowser. It reimagines the true story of a real woman who was born into slavery in Virginia and who ended up posing as a slave in the Confederate White House as part of a spy ring for the Union against the Confederacy. I went online and I saw your photo. You look like you're not an African-American. You look like you're white. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am.
And you explore, I think, in this relationship between Mary Bowser and Bette Van Leeuw, who, you know, was instrumental in freeing her and in getting her involved in the abolition movement and as a spy, you explore some of the more prickly aspects of the relationship between them as former master and slave, as black and white, you know, kind of all those issues that have to do around privilege and how people who have privilege, you know, may have a pretty difficult way to understand what it's like to be on the other side of that. What was this relationship between them?
Well, I think they each have initial ideas of who the other is. And those ideas are not, they don't involve animosity or antagonism. That has always been, as far as Mary can remember, opposed to slavery, although she doesn't always understand the ramifications of the choices that she makes. But that they have to kind of learn that their assumptions about each one about the other are not always accurate. And they also ultimately have to show each other how important each one is to the other. By the end of the book, Mary is in her mid-20s. So she isn't fully an adult, although her entire life has been spent in somehow in relationship to Bette. And it is a really important relationship for both of them. And I think that there are other moments in the book and other relationships in the book, relationships between black characters and white characters that also take on some of this. But it's particularly intense between the two of them. And there's a moment where Mary realizes about Bette. She says, you know, she wanted to see me free and educated when the only other people who wanted that for me were my parents. On the one hand, she sees this immense value in Mary. And on the other hand, she is somebody who lives with a huge amount of privilege, and she can't even understand that. So when Mary, after living free in the North and being educated, returns to the South, Mary realizes that even before they start spying, that she has to present herself as though she's still a slave. Because remember, it's illegal for free blacks to come back into the state of Virginia. So she's prepared to take on that role even before she has to spy, just because they know that war is coming and she wants to be able to be in Richmond to help along the war effort, whatever will transpire. And Bette is very uncomfortable with that. And Mary says, well, you know, you still expect to call me to call you Miss Bette. In this whole conversation, she's saying, well, Mary, I really don't think. And Mary is saying, well, Miss Bette, I really think. And finally, Mary says, you know, you still expect me to call you Miss Bette. And Bette doesn't answer, but it is her non-answer is the closest she can get to admitting that she's wrong. That is to say, she's grown up in a world in which black people respond to white people, even if they were not your owners in a particular way. You always said Miss or Mr., or if even if it wasn't master or mistress, you, and yet blacks were always called by their first name. So just each one of them kind of having to shake out of their expectations of their relationship. And again, having to realize more and more what it means to rely one on the other over the course of the book. And in terms of my coming to write this, you know, I had really been teaching and thinking a lot about race in America for a long time before I started writing this book. And part of that was that I, like many young women, went off to college and read and learned feminist theory and feminist criticism and felt really empowered talking about gender, but there were a lot of Black feminists, Audre Lorde and bell hooks, June Jordan, who were saying in their own writing and their own work, you know, we can't just talk about gender, that gender and race and class always work together. And I think that example of Bette expecting to be called Miss Bette is about race, and it's also about class and how inseparable those things are. And so that really inspired me to specialize in studying African-American literature. I got to read, and I get to read and to teach fantastic literature by Black writers. And so I feel like this book owes a lot to those writers. It owes a lot to the professors who taught me and to being ready to take that leap. I think that in some ways, it would have been a safer move for me to make to write this book from Bette Van Leeuw's point of view. Safer for me because although I've never lived, you know, I don't live in Virginia, I've never lived in a slaveholding society. You know, there are many differences between me and Bette. People expect that when you're crossing the race line to write, but that's a bigger leap than writing somebody from a different religion or, you know, other kinds of differences.
We're talking with Lois Levine about her book, The Secrets of Mary Bowser. You know, another point that I think maybe perhaps I understand now why the role of African Americans in the abolition movement has been so ignored, I think. I mean, you mentioned the movie Lincoln. You know, I think there's like a cameo appearance, you know, of the African-Americans who were involved in the struggle. Their role is really not talked about at all. Talk a little bit more about the role of African-Americans and African-American women in the abolition movement, maybe beyond Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth, who I think are the only ones that we have heard of.
Sure. And, you know, one of my decisions in how to write the novel was not only to give Mary's childhood in Richmond, but also the years that she spends living in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia did have a vibrant Black community. They weren't all wealthy, and some of them were living, you know, in dire poverty, but there was a Black community there that was very politically active around abolition and other issues. And that you're right, Lincoln didn't wake up one day an abolitionist, that came from a long push by Black activists and white activists working sometimes together and sometimes at loggerheads about what to do about a system that was enslaving millions and millions and millions of people in our country. So there are many characters in this novel, Sarah Maps Douglas, Grace Maps, Margaretta Fortin, Robert Purvis, David Bastille Bowser, who are real people. And it was a pleasure for me to kind of weave their stories into this novel and give people a sense of how rich that anti-slavery community was, but also how divided they might be. So, for example, one of the things that happens over the course of the novel is John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. Brown is an abolitionist. And he was very extreme, and he tried to seize a federal arsenal. This is long before the Civil War. Tried to seize a federal arsenal in Virginia and take the munitions out and arm slaves for a wide-scale slave rebellion. Doesn't work out. And there's a lot in the novel about people in the North responding to this. So Mary's living in Philadelphia and realizing that some of the people who are involved in the anti-slavery movement, their responses to John Brown's raid or their responses to the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin are very different than her own, and that there's not one abolitionist position to have, but also that the work that, as you said, women are doing is in some ways very powerful. I think that obviously Harriet Tubman is part of the Underground Railroad is a name that we know, but that there were many ways that people challenge slavery and trying to illustrate those without, you know, without this reading like a history book, but reading like the story of one incredible character, but letting her encounter so many of, whether they're real or fictional characters, but characters who are based in that long history of anti-slavery work, which really starts, you know, from before this country is founded. One of the people, Mary, is a book junkie. She's an autobiographical character in that sense. I love to read, and she loves to read. And so at the back of the novel, I have Mary's reading list. It's all of the things that she mentions reading over the course of the novel. And one of the people that she reads is Phyllis Wheatley, who was a slave and who published her first book of poetry while she was still a child. I mean, she was a teenager, and while she was still enslaved. And that's kind of a mind-blowing fact right there. But the way that Wheatley writes about slavery is a very complicated message, because she wants to critique an institution that she is also subject to. So, you know, letting people know about Phyllis Wheatley, about Frances Harper, who another person on Mary's reading list, just to kind of build this sense of, yeah, the Emancipation Proclamation was decades and decades and decades in the making. And as you said, it is a history that we're still learning. Sometimes it's a history that we're still learning. I'm still doing research on Mary Bowser and still finding documents about Mary Bowser that no historians have known about. But sometimes it's a history that we're still learning just because we like a great man story.
We haven't yet talked about, you know, maybe the most amazing part of the story, and that was Mary Bowser's work as a spy right within the Confederate White House, in the home of Jefferson Davis. How did she accomplish this?
Well, I like to say she wasn't above suspicion so much as she was kind of below suspicion. That as a Black, and particularly a female, being in a domestic space, the idea that you were there was not surprising. I mean, there were slave owners who slept with slaves in their room. So whatever you were doing with your husband or wife happened with a slave in the same room.
But she was pretending to be a slave.
Yes. Yeah. And so I was talking to somebody who had read the book, who said, I just can't believe that they would never suspect that she did it. And we were in a room full of people. And I said, well, okay, of all the women who are in the room right now, how many of you have ever been someplace where somebody assumed you aren't as smart as you are because you're female? And all the women had stories to tell. So I think that that idea of knowing that you've been written off is something that we can still relate to, obviously not on this scale, but in some ways, this is what was most amazing to me. I guess there are two parts. One is that the system of slavery denied the humanity of African Americans by saying they were not capable of intelligence, the same way that you could buy and sell a horse or an ox, you could buy or sell a Black because they weren't really human. They weren't really capable of intelligence. And by working within that stereotype, Mary Bowser proved the importance of Black intelligence, because she became an intelligence agent, an actual spy. So I like that idea. And I also have come to realize that in some ways slavery is the perfect training for a spy. Because when you are a slave, your survival and the survival of your family and the survival of your community depends on you living a double life. You are told you are one thing when you know you are something else. You are told that there are things that you can't do that you are always trying to do. You are told that there are things you must do that you're always trying to not do. You are always living surreptitiously. So, of course, a slave would understand how to be a spy, that even long before Mary becomes a spy, even when she's a child and she's in slavery, the slaves in the family know that information is their most valuable commodity, that when the slave master dies, you want to know what his will says, because that will is going to tell you whether you and your children are going to get to live together anymore or not. You need information, and how do you get information? So using that kind of slavery as training for a spy, but also using the way that the assumptions of the slave owners could be used against them. How do you fight a system that is so dominating, that has you in such complete subordination? Well, you have to figure out how to do that within that system. And so playing to the expectations that slaves were stupid, that slaves were illiterate, that slaves had no connection outside of their immediate world, Mary was able to have access to information, and she was able to be part of a very sophisticated network to share that information outside of the Confederacy to the Union generals and the Union military leadership.
Lois Levine is a regular contributor to Disunion, the New York Times series about the Civil War. You can hear the entire interview I did with her in 2013 by going to writersvoice.net. And later in the season, we'll be talking with Lois Levine about her latest novel based on Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. It's called Juliet's Nurse. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.